This is Healthline, a joint venture of WTIC News Talk 1080 and Yale Cancer Center. Yale Cancer Center is a resource for cancer programs throughout Connecticut, developing new advances in prevention, screening, diagnosis, and treatment. On Healthline, you'll hear from some of the leading doctors in the country. Healthline is not intended to provide medical advice. Yale Cancer Center urges you to consult with a qualified physician in your community for diagnosis and for answers to your medical questions. And now, our co-hosts, oncologists Ken Miller and Ed Chu.
Good morning and welcome to Healthline. My name is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm the director of the Survivorship Program at the Yale Cancer Center in New Haven. I'm here in the WTIC studios with my colleague and co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, who's the chief adult oncologist at the Yale Cancer Center. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Ken. Healthline with the Yale Cancer Center is our way of providing you with the most up-to-date information on cancer care every Sunday morning at 8:30 a.m. here on this station, WTIC News Talk 1080. Our Healthline program features some of the nation's leading oncologists and cancer specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer right here in our state of Connecticut.
Each week, Ed and I will be joined by a different expert from the Yale Cancer Center. Together, we will discuss the myths about cancer, the latest treatment available to people with cancer, and advances in clinical research. Our goal is to give you help and hope. We'd like to give you help by sharing information. We'd also, again, very important to share with you our hope, because cancer is a disease which is treatable and curable. We will answer your questions and give you the latest information on cancer. And if you'd like to submit a question about cancer to Healthline, please email us at healthline@yale.edu, or you can call, and I'd ask you to write down this number, 888-234-4YCC. And we will try to answer your questions on the air or today or in a future broadcast.
Today, our program focuses on the advances in the detection and treatment of ovarian cancer. And our special guest is Dr. Tom Rutherford, Associate Professor of Gynecologic Oncology and a leading expert in the detection and treatment of ovarian cancer here at the Yale Cancer Center. Tom, thanks so much for being with us today on Healthline.
Thank you.
Tom, I'd like to start with a brief overview. Basically, what is ovarian cancer and how common is it?
Ovarian cancer is not a very common tumor. And basically, we need to look at what age group do these cancers occur. In the younger age group, these are ladies in their teens, 20s, early 30s. They develop a type of ovarian cancer called a germ cell tumor. These tumors are seen relatively in young women, and they are entirely different than what we think about as an ovarian cancer. When we think about an ovarian cancer, we think about the Guillain-Barré ovarian cancer, which is an epithelial type of tumor. These generally occur in women of 45 years of age and older. They generally are tumors that, when we think about them being detected, they're detected later than earlier. And on the ovarian epithelial tumors, the Guillain-Barré ovarian cancer, these tumors are broken down into two types, one being the epithelial, like what we think about with Guillain-Barré, and the second one being what's called a borderline type of ovarian cancer. It is still an ovarian cancer, but it's treated differently than what the epithelial tumors are treated.
Tom, for the most common form of ovarian cancer, which I gather is the epithelial type, the Guillain-Barré type.
That's correct.
What are the main risk factors associated?
Well, the real risk factors, the bottom line, we do not really know. We do know, however, that there appears to be a genetic link. That comes into the BRCA1 and 2 links. We know that these tumors occur in families, meaning people who have family histories of ovarian, breast, colon, prostate, pancreatic. These tumors occur as a genetic subset of families, and a lot of times we don't know why they occur. They can be carried both through male and through female lines, meaning mom has it or grandmom has an ovarian cancer. I'm the son. I don't have any daughters, and I have a son and pass it on, and my grandchildren could then have that female have ovarian cancer. It can pass on right through the male. So there is a link that goes through the male.
All right. I think you've answered it, but I want to go back over this again because I think it's fascinating and very important information, because there is a myth. Many women believe and people believe that there is not a risk of developing ovarian cancer if you don't have a family history, or there's not a risk if it's not on your mother's side of the family. So can you go back?
Yeah, that's correct. Most ovarian cancers we know today are what's called sporadic ovarian cancers. That means they occur and we don't know why or if there's any previous history. A good number of patients have no previous history of ovarian cancer in their family. They may have a large history of a breast, they may have a large history of colon, but some of these people have absolutely no history at all of cancer at all. The risk of ovarian cancer is 1 in 70 in the general population. And if you compare that to breast cancer, which is 1 in 8, you can see that it is much less common. And that's why it's often much harder to detect.
And if a woman should have mutations in the BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene, how much does that increase the risk for developing ovarian cancer?
If you have a mutational defect, BRCA1 or 2, you can have the risk up to 85% based upon age of 85. So you have to, if you have the whole population living to 85, you have a very high risk of developing the cancer.
Hmm. And if a woman should have, for instance, a prior history of breast cancer and also has the mutation either BRCA1 or BRCA2, does that then place that woman at increased risk for developing ovarian cancer?
Actually, it does. With a BRCA2 positive patient, that does increase the risk significantly for a fallopian tube cancer, which is consistent with an ovarian cancer. The fallopian tubes in the ovaries are very close proximity coming off the uterus, and many times they're indistinguishable from being one tumor to the other until you actually do the surgery and get the tumor mass down in pathology so they can pinpoint where it started.
Tom, who should be screened for ovarian cancer? It's just a very general question.
There's definitely the high-risk population that needs to be looked at. And the Ashkenazi Jewish population is known to have an increase in mutations and an increase in ovarian cancers. People with ovarian, breast, or family histories of ovarian, breast, colon, prostate, pancreatic should be screened. A patient who has a colon cancer or a breast cancer are at higher risk for an ovarian cancer. But the real answer is probably the entire population. And this is part of a routine GYN examination that should be performed as a part of examination. You do a routine pelvic exam, and that should be done on a yearly basis.
Tom, if there's a very strong family history of ovarian cancer, are there any genetic tests that can be done? And what do we have here available at the Yale Cancer Center?
Well, what we have developed, let me back up just one step. Everybody has heard about the CA125, okay?
No. I'm not sure everybody's heard, okay. So
yeah,
tell us.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what CA125 really means and stands for.
Okay. A CA125 is a serum blood test. It's used to monitor or follow response to people with ovarian cancer. It's one of the more common tests that everybody thinks about when they think about ovarian cancer. It's sort of like the PSA and prostate cancers. The problem with the CA125 is that patients who have early stage 1 and 2 ovarian cancer, most of the time, or 40 to 50% of the time, do not have an elevated CA125. Unfortunately, patients who come in with advanced cancer, which is stage 3 or 4, often do have elevations in the CA125. So what we're using it not so much for screening, but we're following it for determination, is the treatment we're providing beneficial. Now, at Yale, we have come up with a new blood test. And this test is looking at blood markers or proteins in the blood that may be elevated if a patient has ovarian cancer. We currently have this test out. It has been marketed to LabCorp, who is in the process of bringing the test out on a national level. Currently, in this area, we're evaluating patients. We take a blood test. We run the test and see if there's an elevation in these blood markers, and based on that, will give us some indication, is there evidence of a tumor.
Would your prediction be that as we look into the future, that we'll be able, with a blood test like this, to be able to detect ovarian cancer earlier, and will that have an impact on the cure rate?
The answer is, I believe in time, we're going to be able to detect these tumors much earlier than we can currently. The test currently is being run not on a wide screen, but looking at patients who do have cancer and patients who are in a screening program that we have here at Yale. We've been able to determine that a patient has recurrent disease prior to that patient being picked up by routine CA-125s, physical exams, CAT scans, or any evidence of symptoms from the disease. We are also able to determine that a patient has an elevation, and by getting an ultrasound, found out that she had a very small nodule in an ovary, which at first I did not think to be malignant. And then it turned out that she did have an early ovarian cancer. All the time that the CA-125 was normal. The other problem with the CA-125, I want to tell you, is the problem of the false positive elevation. The CA-125 can be elevated due to menopause, or excuse me, CA-125 can be elevated due to menses, pregnancy, endometriosis, diabetes, or anything that causes irritation of the abdominal cavity, such as diverticular disease in the older age. So that is actually one of the big problems with that serum test. With the new test that we're looking at, that does not seem to be a problem.
Tom, maybe let's just take a step back and go back to the basics for our listening audience. What are some of the symptoms that are typically associated with ovarian cancer?
The problem with ovarian cancer is a disease that whispers. It's a symptom that you go out to dinner, you had a spaghetti dinner, you have a little bit of acid from the dinner, and it goes away the next morning. And 2 weeks later, you had some fish, and it just didn't quite sit right. And then you have a little bit of abdominal pain, but you were lifting something. And this goes on for month after month after month. Ultimately, people who are having changes in their bowel or their bladder function, people having persistent, recurrent abdominal pain, people who have abdominal bloating need to have a pelvic evaluation. Because if you look at the people with ovarian cancer, many times or most patients are found to have symptoms for 6 to 9 months prior to being diagnosed. But it's a disease that whispers.
Well, we'd like to remind you to please email your questions to us at healthline@yale.edu. You can also call us. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. And please stay tuned to learn more information about the detection and treatment of ovarian cancer with Dr. Tom Rutherford from the Yale Cancer Center.
This is a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. Cancer patients become cancer survivors the first day they're diagnosed. There are over 10 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. However, there are long-term side effects of cancer, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, impaired growth, and an increased risk of second cancers. Ending cancer treatment can be both exciting and scary. Most people are relieved to be finished with the demands of treatment, but many also feel concerned about whether the cancer will come back and what they can do to prevent a relapse. Cancer survivors require long-term specialized care and support. For more information, log on to www.yalecancercenter.org. That address once again, www.yalecancercenter.org.
Well, welcome back to Healthline. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm in the WTIC studios with my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and our guest, Dr. Tom Rutherford, who's an expert from the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at the Yale Cancer Center.
Tom, we were just talking about the symptoms associated with ovarian cancer, and you were really emphasizing the point that ovarian cancer really is kind of a whispering disease. It doesn't really present with classic, typical symptoms. But how does ovarian cancer get diagnosed?
Many times what happens is a patient is seen first by their primary care for persistent, they're treated for the flu or GI bug. Then that persists, they're sent to a GI physician who often does the colonoscopy or the upper GI series. And then the symptoms continue and then they get a CAT scan. So it's an accidental diagnosis because many times these masses are much smaller than a pregnancy. So you don't see a big mass or the abdomen becoming enlarged. Many times, however, as the patient is going through these symptoms, all of a sudden she has a massive accumulation of fluid in the abdomen called ascites. And off that massive bloating that occurs, that's what tips off an advanced ovarian cancer.
Tom, it's been exciting to hear about some of the new screening techniques that are available and are becoming available, and especially a lot of work that's been done at Yale in terms of screening. But for women who are diagnosed with early stage ovarian cancer, what is the treatment?
The treatment for an ovarian cancer is basically surgical excision and staging of the disease, which means what we want to do is take out the primary tumor. If she is in childbearing years yet, you want to do the surgery. If it's limited to that ovary, you want to still look at the lymph nodes along the major vessels in the abdomen and pelvis. There's a fat pad that hangs off the stomach called the omentum. Our tumors often go there, so we would sample that area. And again, if pregnancy is a thing that we need to think about, no other disease, we would do what's called a conservative surgery, meaning we leave the other ovary if it looks normal in the uterus. If the lady is not thinking about future fertility and thinking about having children later, we would do a complete hysterectomy, taking out the uterus, cervix, tubes, and ovaries, and taking out the lymph nodes as well as the omentum.
So, Tom, once a surgery has been performed, is there any role for giving adjuvant chemotherapy afterwards?
If a patient has tumor confined to the one ovary, if that tumor is what's called a well-differentiated tumor, she may not need to have chemotherapy. But if the tumor is stuck in the pelvis, meaning it's a little more than a stage one, or if there's more disease, or if it's a high-grade disease, an adjuvant chemotherapy would be appropriate for that patient.
Now, earlier this year, there was a great deal of buzz that was coming out of a recent study showing that intraperitoneal chemotherapy seemed to confer advantage to women following surgery. Perhaps you could elaborate a little bit more on that.
The intraperitoneal chemotherapy study was performed in patients with advanced disease.
Okay.
So it was not an early disease trial. Most, if you look at survival in the patients in one and two, we actually do very good because we're able to resect the disease in total. And our survival is probably, in our hands, better than 80, 85%, 90%.
Tom, we're going to take a break in a minute, but I did want to share with you an email that we received. It's from Anne, who lives in Brantford. She says, I'm 36 years old. I've been under treatment for infertility for 3 years. At what point should I become concerned with the possibility that the fertility drugs could cause ovarian cancer?
There has been some documentation in the literature that fertility drugs may increase your incidence of cancer. The rate of risk would be minimal at best. So what we would still need to do is follow her closely on routine examinations twice a year. The question comes down, does the drug cause a rate of risk, or is the primary infertility the really cause and the drugs are just coming along for the ride? And the answer is we don't know.
In follow-up to that question, and a bit of a twist, is there any evidence to suggest that estrogen supplementation might increase the risk for developing ovarian cancer?
Actually not. In fact, patients who are on birth control pills will decrease their risk of ovarian cancer significantly. The other thing to decrease the risk of ovarian cancer is a tubal ligation prior to the age of 35. The also interesting thing on the tubal ligation, it also decreases your risk of breast cancer.
Which is fascinating information. Well, we're going to take a break in a minute for a survivor story. We'd like to remind you to please email your questions to us at healthline@yale.edu. Again, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with Dr. Tom Rutherford to learn more about ovarian cancer.
A few years ago, the diagnosis of cancer was a death sentence for many patients. But today, thanks to advances in clinical research, we're turning the corner in the battle against cancer. There are over 10 million cancer survivors now living in the U.S. They are the true heroes in the war against cancer. Here's the story of a hero from Guilford.
My name is Kathy. I'm a cancer survivor, and I'm the mother of three girls. I was diagnosed with breast cancer at age 40. I had had my baseline mammogram at 36, but with no family history of breast cancer, I was told to return when I was 40 for another mammogram. I got the diagnosis that no one prepares you for, cancer. But I was lucky. I was referred to the Yale Cancer Center, where I met Dr. Lannan. I underwent a double mastectomy in the summer of 2004. I still take tamoxifen daily, but have been cancer-free ever since. If there is one message that I want to convey to all women, it is to get a regular mammogram. I am a perfect example of how early detection is part of the cure.
This survivor's story has been brought to you by Yale Cancer Center.
Welcome back to Healthline. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm in the WTIC studios with my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and our guest, Dr. Tom Rutherford, who's an expert in the detection and treatment of ovarian cancer at the Yale Cancer Center. Tom, I wanted to start out by asking you about women who have more advanced ovarian cancer. And in terms of treatment for them, we were talking a couple minutes ago about how some women have surgery and then have chemotherapy. For women with advanced ovarian cancer, do you ever do it the other way around?
Yes, we do. It's called neoadjuvant chemotherapy. If you have a patient that we do not deem to be surgically resectable due to the volume of disease, usually up around the gallbladder fossa or into what's called the mesentery, which is support tissue of the bowel, what we would do is treat that patient with chemotherapy. Once we have the disease that would shrink down, then we would take them to the OR to surgically perform the original surgical staging that we do routinely for an ovarian cancer, after which we would put them back on chemotherapy. This is actually a treatment modality that was originated at Yale by Dr. Peter Swartz, and has actually led to the treatment of many other advanced cancers, as in colon and breast, to be treated in the same modality.
Tom, I know that you've played a very leading role in developing new clinical trials for the treatment of patients with advanced metastatic ovarian cancer. And please discuss with our viewers and our listeners what's going on in your clinical investigations program.
Currently, we have a drug called phenoxidyl. And we looked at, in the laboratory, at cell lines being treated with phenoxidyl to see the effect that phenoxidyl has. And what we found is it caused the cell lines to die. And the question was why. If you have a normal cell, it should undergo what's called apoptosis at the end of its life. A cancer cell has lost the ability to do apoptosis, which is a programmed cell death. All cells need to do this. And with the reason that the cancer cell becomes problematic is it loses the ability to die. What we found that this drug, phenoxidyl, will reverse one of the blockers to apoptosis, allowing the cell to go on and die. The other thing we found is that if you take that blocker off that pathway and then treat them with chemotherapy, you need much less chemotherapy to affect the same response as chemotherapy alone. So phenoxidyl seems to be a biologic modifier of a pathway to let a cell go on and die.
And I think what's really fascinating about this drug, phenoxidyl, which apparently comes from a plant in Australia,
that's correct,
is that it's able to reverse the development of drug resistance, and in other words, restore chemosensitivity. So as a pharmacologist, I think this is just, you know, fantastic.
That's absolutely correct. We have a trial that we just completed looking at patients who are either platinum, meaning cisplatinum or carboplatinum, or Taxol or Taxotere resistant. We put them back on phenoxidyl and retreated the patient with the drug that they were resistant to and affected a response in about 40% of the patients, so a pretty good response rate. We currently are looking at how to give the drug phenoxidyl. As with any new product, you're never sure, should I give it IV, should I give it orally? So we have another trial looking at patients who are previously treated and have recurred, and now we are placing them on oral, so you're taking a pill, phenoxidyl, and then treating them with a drug called Taxotere. It's a cousin to Taxol.
Now, if these drugs are effective in reversing the resistance to these terrific chemotherapy drugs in the treatment of ovarian cancer, might they eventually be helpful when used earlier for women who are first diagnosed with ovarian cancer?
The thought would be yes. We obviously do not have the trial to prove that. The phenoxidyl is currently going to a national trial. It's a phase 3 trial. It's being piloted through the NCI. There's going to be about 12 or 15 sites involved, and I would expect that this trial sometime this fall would begin. So we've been able to take this drug from the laboratory all the way through to a phase 3 in approximately 4 years of time.
Which is really fantastic when you think about it, because in terms of classic drug development, the whole process may take up to 8 to 10 years. So it looks like you've really been able to accelerate the process. I think the other very interesting aspect of phenoxidyl is that in addition to being very effective in ovarian cancer, it looks like there's also pretty promising activity in other cancers as well. Is that right?
That's correct. It has seems to show some activity that it can reactivate the apoptotic pathways.
Tom, I wanted to ask you, one of the programs that I've heard about at Yale but don't know much about is the Discovery to Cure program. What is that?
Discovery to Cure is a program set for early detection and screening. And what we're trying to do is detect the cancer before it becomes advanced stage, which obviously is difficult. As in a pap smear, we know if we screen for cervical cancer, if we find it early, we cure it. What we're looking at are the blood tests that we've developed. So it's the proteomics have led us to develop four proteins in a serum test. We also have several experimental blood markers that we're looking at, or blood proteins we're looking at, that seem to have major impact too. So I think the test is actually going to expand and hopefully become a little more sensitive. Currently, the sensitivity and specificity is 95%, which is very good.
It is.
When you think about a pap smear, 66%. Mm-hmm. So we have hopes that we will be able to detect people at an early stage. And so far, we've been able to determine that some people have been picked up with an early ovarian cancer through this testing.
Now, if someone, one of our listening audience or their family or friends wants to participate in a clinical trial or in a screening trial, how would they get in contact with Yale or the Yale Cancer Center in terms of participation?
We have two ways. We can call our office directly, and we're at GYN Oncology at 785-4176. And the second way we can have them is look at the YaleCancerCenter.org website.
Tom, let me ask you along those lines, in terms of other clinical research that's being done at the Yale Cancer Center and GYN Oncology, any other clinical trials that you'd like to tell us about?
We're a member of Society of Gynecologic Oncology Group, so they have approximately at the current time we have about 16 open trials running. These trials are not only looking at different chemotherapy modalities, new drug therapies, but we're also looking at modalities to improve or decrease the toxicity of the drugs. Some of the trials we're looking at are from China, being a ban to decrease nausea with chemotherapy. We have trials looking at, does chemotherapy or surgery affect the thought processes? We have trials looking at, does chemotherapy affect the bone density in patients? Because obviously, once I cure you, I want you to have your normal bone density. We have other trials looking at, can I predict what the cancer cell will respond to, such that if I give you a drug, I know that that cancer will respond to that drug. And we have two trials going on, one being with Precision Therapeutics, looking at, I give them a piece of tumor, we determine what is it going to be sensitive to. And the second, we're doing is looking at a drug called, or a compound called MyD88, where I know that if a tumor has this protein, it will be resistant to taxane therapy. So this is in the early trial, and that's also leading to new drug development for us.
Well, if you have questions for Dr. Tom Rutherford or for Healthline, I encourage you to go to our website, YaleCancerCenter.org, for more information about cancer and the resources available for you. Before we sign off, Tom, in your opinion, what are the key points that you would like to share with the listening audience about the detection and treatment of ovarian cancer?
I think any patient that is having persistent GI discomfort and upset needs to be evaluated by a GYN physician. And if determined that she does have a GYN cancer, she should be seen by a GYN oncologist.
I'd like to thank Dr. Tom Rutherford for joining us for Healthline for this very, very interesting session.
Yeah, I too also would like to thank Tom for, I think, a very, very informative session for our listening audience. And remember, tune in to WTIC News Talk 1080 every Sunday morning at 8:30 a.m. for Healthline with the Yale Cancer Center. Our next program will focus on cancer prevention, and our special guest will be Dr. Susan Main, Director of the Cancer Prevention and Control Program at the Yale Cancer Center. Until then, this is Dr. Ed Chu.
And Dr. Ken Miller.
From the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
You've been listening to Healthline, a joint venture of Yale Cancer Center and WTIC News Talk 1080. Join us next Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 a.m. for another edition of Healthline on WTIC News Talk 1080.